Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted. We've had a few more people from the UK on recently, and that makes my heart sink, because I think that we need more Brits on this show, and especially we need more Northerners, because I'm a Northerner and I'm welcoming Steph to the show, a fellow Northerner. She's a bit further north than me, but hello, welcome to the show, Steph.
Thank you, Simon. It was lovely to connect with you, and I've been listening to as many podcasts as I can because they've been so interesting.
Yeah. So you know what happens next. I ask you to introduce yourself to the listener.
I hope I'll do my best, because I'm aware that, and I tend to explain that actually, if I'm working with adoptees and adopted parents, I think it's really important to be authentic, that I'm not adopted and I haven't adopted, but my whole career, which is getting on now because I was 50 recently. I think I'm being really authentic about it to get used to it. So for 20, 30 years, I've worked with a lot of adoptive families, adopted children, adopted adults, birth parents, adoptive parents. I'm really passionate about helping them. And I think there's a lot of loss and pain and sorrow, as well as joy and reward. And I hope I can do justice in the various strands of work I do, whether it's training or therapy or lecturing. But I just think it's really important. I think it's really important that I understand adoption affects directly 20% of society. So actually, the more as a society we listen to podcasts, or we understand, or we try, or we read more, then maybe we can have just a bit more thought and compassion and sensitivity for adopted adults who may have been wounded by early separations, and adopted parents who have the pain sometimes of infertility, and then the later pain that the children have been through a lot. So incredibly important to me, and one of the most important parts of the work and that I do, and I'm really privileged. I currently I'm vice chair of an adoption panel and do training. I've been delivering webinars for the Adopter Hub. And I was going to say, and I ended up trying to explain myself, justify. The most of my career has been mental health services, and that's where I first started work with adoptive families. And I set up and managed a mental health service for cared for and adopted children, because they disproportionately, because of the trauma and loss experience challenge. I think society should change too. We should adapt, schools should adapt. It's about society's adjustment too, the structural factors that make it hard for people who've experienced loss and challenge. But I'm currently doing a bit of self-employed and a bit of lecturing, a bit of everything, because I really, really enjoy what I do. A bit of everything, teaching, making webinars around adoption for the Adopter Hub. What else? Some therapy, some adoption support funded therapy. So a bit of everything, but passionate about adoption and the well-being of adopted children, young people and their parents. Gosh, is that a long introduction, Simon?
That's great. I love it, yeah. You need to look at the picture on the episode for this podcast, listeners, and you will see that this lady does not look 50.
You're very kind. Maybe it's the fortune that I think it's a huge privilege to work with people who were going through challenging times, because I think it can help your own post-traumatic growth, because that's about doing good, helping if I can. And maybe if I'm fortunate enough not to look 50, although 50 is probably the new 40, I'm telling myself, maybe there is a real privilege in helping others. Yeah, maybe. I hope. I feel very lucky. I've had 25 years of being a social worker and then got into therapies and different. And I've been very lucky. I've worked with some amazing families and people.
Yeah. Well, it always shows when we love what we do, right?
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Yeah. And you mentioned three little words that I don't think are well enough known. Can you guess what those were from what you just told me?
Oh, no. The three little words.
Post, traumatic. Growth.
Oh, yes. Something I love teaching about, because I think we need to have these stories of hope. I've presented in Malta the first time. I think it was Malta. I've been lucky enough to present there 3 times. That isn't boasting. It's just been an absolute joy. And I think it's the first time I kind of did the further research and added that in, because we must have hope. And it was lovely. There was a lovely feedback at the end, because we used some video footage of adopted children, and the therapies we were involved in at the time. And we have to have hope, and the growth does come. I think some of the adopted families I've worked with have been some of the best people I've ever met, because they've been touched by pain, but they're able to really, really connect and be really compassionate people. So we totally believe in post-traumatic growth.
Okay, so what is it?
What is it? Well, this is like teaching without the slides. I think that when you've been touched by pain, sorrow, hurt, and it can come in different points in a journey for an adoptee. Sometimes it's adulthood, sometimes it's often teen years, when it's the identity and the longing, and that we now know social media, a lot of birth parents reach out, and that can be tough. When you've gone through some of these really tough times, some of the adoptees have, and then the tough times for adopters and birth parents, all in the triangle, have loss and pain. But I do think there's recovery. I've seen young people do incredibly well. I will send probably to a family I know, if when this is produced, if it's good enough, Simon. There's a family I work with that I can't obviously name, but the young person spent a couple of years in their bedroom. They'd accessing the curriculum for some adopted children is really tough. If you've experienced early developmental trauma, it can be really tough, hard to concentrate, hypervigilance if you've been hurt. And this amazing young man, because he's doing amazing now, because he's currently in college today. So super proud if he does hear this. Super proud. I have a fabulous card ready to post. But he had a couple of really tough years. And I think we can get into complicated thinking about children who've experienced early trauma, because I was fairly certain early on, unless the right school or curriculum environment was found, that you couldn't probably recover from the early trauma, because you need contact with humans to recover from trauma. You need warmth, you need connection. And now I think he will have post-traumatic growth, and I definitely think his parents will. His mum's one of the nicest women you could meet. She's so intuitive. She's so compassionate. She's a wonderful adopted mum. But he's a really lovely young man. So I think the figures suggest 70% do better after the pain, after whether it's a kind of breakdown or the peak of the struggle. And I think that's true. Some of the adoptees I've met, and they've just been the most intuitive, thoughtful people, and have so much to offer. And I guess when we talked about the podcast, which was lovely, and I'm sorry, I was filled with cold, so I think I coughed the whole conversation. But I wanted to talk about co-production, which is a fancy word. I know post-traumatic growth can sound fancy, and I'm from a mine village. I'm not fancy initially. So it's a lot of learning in the last 30 years. But I think that post-traumatic growth is more likely to come when we have that meaningful connection with the family, where we really co-produce or work on what's tough together. We really mutually respect what the adoptive family have to bring, because they're the ones who understand trauma. They understand difficult experiences and honouring them. And then, yes, I think they have richness to offer other humans about kindness and care and process and loss. And I think that's why it's so fantastic that a lot of the great voices in adoption are adoptees. I've got to say it right, haven't I? And some of the work that I've really been most touched by that I've been involved with has been that co-production, like the film Social Work England kindly funded me to make last year, which I will get to you, Simon. We've had technical issues, but it is intact. One of the lovely people who's involved in the film, Colin McGinn. He's kindly kept the film. I'm not the best at technology, but they kindly funded the filmmaking from research I undertook with those who'd been in care or adopted about their experiences. And then we made it into a training film.
Can I ask you about that co-production thing then? So
yeah,
can you give us some pointers? Yeah, sounds interesting, Steph.
I think at the heart of services for cared for and adopted children, they need to be involved. They are the people with the capacity to say what's tricky. And obviously mental health services usually involve a young person in the care plan, but I actually think we need to properly involve them in all sorts of areas of service delivery.
So for parents listening, right, for adoptive parents listening, does co-production have is that something that they can get involved in? How can they co-produce with their kids?
I think that's fantastic. As an idea, yeah, I like that. That's really clever because, I think they absolutely have to. Because it's getting at the heart of what's tricky and what's needed. And it's tougher with adoption because sometimes it's respecting that what is tricky is the issues related to birth, family issues related to loss. And adoptive parents have often experienced a lot of loss. They've experienced infertility, many of them, or secondary infertility, where they've perhaps haven't had one child and couldn't conceive another. And then some of the issues resonate. So that co-production, that recognition of what's tricky for their child is the adoption, is the wondering about the birth parents, that can raise really primitive feelings in the adopters of envy and pain and more loss. But at the heart of that thinking, if they have the shared thinking with their child of, right, this...
this is real world. This is the real world. We've got a delivery that's woken up a little dog on the show. So co-production, it's an exploration, is it? Co-production?
Yeah.
So what can we do? Let's get practical. We don't normally do this on the show, right? So, but you've got me thinking co-production is something I'd like to do. And, and so we're back, ladies and gentlemen. And co-production. So what can adoptive parents do? What are some pointers that
Well, I guess it's at the heart of it. It's trying to have a meaning of lived experience. So the lived experience of their adopted child. And it might be misperceptions, especially if it's their younger children. There's that magical thinking age where the children might perceive the birth parents as wonderful and they need life story work. But the heart of it of co-production is an understanding of lived experience to do the best you can for the people you're working with. So if it's adoptive parents, it's trying really hard to connect. So it might be using the kind of Dan Hughes PACE techniques of that curiosity, the connection. And the co-production, I guess, really it's the adoptive parents understanding it to try to get services to do this with them. Because I set a few notes out before we could speak, so I couldn't forget, try to recall the bits that I think are really important. But we know adopted children may have increased special educational needs from a difficult start, especially as the age of adoptions increased. Tony Blair kind of years ago politically understandably didn't want children moving around the care system and pushed for improved performance with adoption. We just had some better life chances for children do better in nurturing homes, But the point being, the children who were adopted from the care system have been through a lot, generally speaking, and they need to be understood. And if it happened when it was pre-verbal, which is the majority, they just have kind of symptoms of trauma that need the parents to understand. And then what the adoptive parents need from services is to understand their lived experience and what they need. So co-production would be really meaningful exchanges with services where at the heart of the care planning. So the co-production, I guess, I've been involved in is research, where we share what needs to be researched rather than me asking the questions. I try to start from a starting point. Are these the right questions to research with adoptive families? I'm really delighted Adopt Northeast, who are a fantastic agency, want me to do an adoptive voice. And I'll be hoping some of the adopters share with me, are these the right questions about understanding? So that, I guess, co-production is the heart. It's not for me to impose my view or my understanding. And yes, I think it'll absolutely help adoptive parents if they try to come from that perspective with the children too. That perspective of what's your understanding, to know what's the tricky stuff for their child, rather than imposing their perception or understanding, which can happen.
Yeah. So it's about exploration. It's about curiosity. It's really? About understanding the fact that some of this stuff is pre-verbal. Mm. It's, so that's the relationship with the child.
Absolutely.
And then maybe some of these Dan Hughes models, as you're saying. And it's also, it sounds to me like it's also kind of being a bit more proactive with the any authorities that you're dealing with, rather than expecting them to know better than you, because or do better than you. So it's a bit like trusting a tradesman, you know. It's more like you're taking a more engaged role. You're not just taking people's word for it. You're trying to push on the agenda yourself rather than seeing them as the experts.
I love the different thoughts you've come to, because yes, and I think it is valuing the lived experiences of adopted children, young people, adults, and their families, because the level of expertise they have. For example, recently someone was describing a unique behaviour by an adopted child, which had a different vocalisation. When we spent time and thought about it and thought about when that arose, because many people were wondering about autism, it's probably a fear behaviour that developed within the birth family, a fear-driven, you know, for the child. And I guess at the heart of that, it's that giving the family where they're together 24/7, honouring their lived experience, because they're usually very good historians, and then you can get to the heart of the understanding. So it takes time to have that real shared understanding, time and connection, but you will get a better outcome the more you really deeply connect with the families and the children.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the point you talked about, the young man who was in his bedroom for a couple of years and now he's at college. And you said that you were, I think you kind of said that, you know, that you're kind of expecting some post-traumatic growth from this guy. It seems to me he's already exhibiting that,
because
he's out of his bedroom and he's into college.
Absolutely, he's putting something back in society. He's learning. He's grown. He's self-reflecting. He's caring, he's got a greater understanding about himself. He's fabulous, and a fabulous family. So it is such a privilege to work with the families who've experienced adoption, because their insight into human relationships is usually quite significant, because they've often had a journey of pain to get there, where children have been frightened in school and nervous and struggled with relationships and hypervigilance and dissociation and all of these trauma symptoms. But when you get there, and actually you're right, Simon, you're right, that the steps young people can take after trauma, we should absolutely honour, because the courage is immense, isn't it? Takes so much more strength after you've experienced traumatic starts. So you're right. You're really good at positive psychology too, Simon.
Well,
you're right.
It's just the way I see it, right? It's the way I see it. It's also the way I've experienced it. So what I've seen, you mentioned earlier on, okay, about we have a lot of complicated thinking. You said we have a lot of complicated thinking about, I think you were talking about trauma. And we do have a lot of complicated thinking. That's for sure. We do have a lot of complicated thinking. And that complicated thinking takes us down. So for me, this is like the metaphor that I always use is the fact that, have you ever been in a swimming pool at the sea, at the seaside, and you've been in the water and you've had a beach ball or a plastic football, and you've tried to push it down underwater, right? So the weight of our thinking and the weight of our thinking around our trauma and the rate of our thinking, it pushes us down. That weighty thinking, the complicated thinking, the complexity and the what if thing and all this. And this happens for all of us. We are weighed down by our thinking.
Yeah.
As we get weighed down, the ball of our mood or our consciousness goes underneath the water. And then something happens. We have an insight. We see something differently. Mm. Or the complicated thinking suddenly becomes simple, or it disappears, right? And I'm not talking about a magical thing here, right? I'm just talking about a new idea. So the new idea that I'm thinking in my head now is, like, when I get into bed at night, sometimes I feel, and I've been full on all day, you know, I'm full on this podcast, right? And my work, I'm full on it, and it's just like, phew, you know. There's a sigh. Yeah. The action stations that I've been on all day, that thinking goes, and my load is lightened, and back to the ball metaphor. When that complicated thinking, when that traumatic thinking, when that trauma feeling, when it goes through an insight, the ball that has been pushed back, pushed down a four or 30 centimeters for our metric friends, bounces up twice as high. And that for me is... That's my experience. When I thought I was wounded, I didn't think I was wounded until I thought I was wounded. And when I thought that, I went down. Mm-hmm. When I realized that who we are, the very essence of who we are, not our thoughts, not our feelings, but the entity underneath all that, spirit, what people might call it, awareness, consciousness, God, some people call it, that's unwoundable. And that's what happened. And when I heard this thing, post-traumatic growth, I thought, that's what happened to me. How can we help more people to that? How can we accelerate that post-traumatic growth? Because we have a media that's obsessed with post-traumatic stress disorder, despite the fact that only 20% of people that go through traumatic stress events, right, get PTSD. Nobody's saying, hey, let's study the 80% of people that don't get post-traumatic stress and find out what went on for them and share that with the others.
No, you're making a good point that we need to honour the value that the people who do well do, as well as reaching out to help others in the struggle. And I think you're right. It's that understanding. I think you made a really good analogy. Somebody I saw the other day who I know has had a really tough experience, and they're a real feeder and caregiver and warm person. We just had a short exchange about how that was probably a survival strategy when they were younger, because it meant that life wasn't so tough in their difficult parenting experience. And you could see the weight lifting because they were understood. And I think if you've had really early tough stuff, it's needing to be around people who understand. And the importance of that co-production is hopefully more and more people understand. So it does have to be at the heart of emotional wellbeing services, adoption services, that adopter voice, that children's voice. We need it for centrality. Yeah. You know, your wonderful analogy is important. The experiences of adopted people is really important, because they're the ones who can explain what it's like to have starts that aren't the same as everyone else, and the differences and identity issues and challenge. But you're absolutely right. We do also need to focus on those who do well, because it's a much greater, greater triumph for children who've been frightened and can't leave home and have had a tough experience. When they do blossom, we should shout it from the rooftops, really. I would love to put them in for an award. But then the stigma with adoption, how can you do that? Because you can't really identify the families you're working with. So it's tricky, but I would love to. So I did want to kind of do a little mention, because they'll know who they are, because such a triumph. So there is so much joy in the work I've been privileged to be able to do, to see that growth.
How do we accelerate? You know, clearly, you know, you're a teacher, you're a trainer, you're a therapist. Therapy is an experience. We can't experience therapy in a podcast conversation. It's not going to work. that doesn't work, right? So, but if with the other hats that you've got, that you have, you know, the teacher and the trainer, the educator, what can you share with the listeners, the adoptive parents listening, and I guess some adoptees as well. I know where the listeners are, but I don't know who they are. I don't know the split, right? So what can you share to help them accelerate this post-traumatic growth? Because that's what we all want, right?
I think be authentic. Be as much as there's stigma and shame still with mental health services, be able to share, try to reach out, find the right people. I think the Adoption Support Fund helps. And we've still got that available where you can reach out for therapy. Find a community. I think the podcasts and the psychosocial education massively helps, because it reduces the guilt and shame. You're not alone in this journey. A lot of people feel this. I hope the teaching and training I do, because I'm passionate about adoption and trauma and attachment, I think the more we widen this, sometimes when I was doing therapy, I would meet grandmas who didn't understand and thought parents were doing a terrible job or being critical or expecting too much of the child. And I would be the person to take on the challenge so that family dynamics were easier, kind of family therapy. And I think use the podcast to share with people who don't understand, if they're willing to listen. Use what resources are out there to widen the lens of understanding around these issues. So I guess it's multifactorial. Sometimes educate those around you. as well as yourself, have enough support, access what's available, try to have a voice in what's available, because most regional adoption agencies should be asking about adopter voice. I'm delighted I will be, so that you can have a lived experience and input into how services are. And try not to feel the shame. Obviously, some children want their story private. Some children don't want everyone to know. And that's to be expected and understood and respected. But feel you have enough support from your adoptive parent, because you're more likely to listen, I guess, than an adopted young person. Have enough support and enough understanding, enough compassion for you to have self-compassion. It can be a hard journey. And then for adoptive adults listening, get what you need in relationships. You need, there may be pain in your childhood that has made you see yourself differently, but find a way that people reach understanding of you, or you reach self-compassion for you. Early childhood experiences, we've had that raised understanding of adverse childhood experiences and ACEs, as they talk about them, but actually try to change the family script about you. I do a lot of narrative work where I write stories to children about how fabulous they are and super children, and change the story about you, because it's a story of hope and courage. Because those who are here and still learning and still engaging that journey of understanding yourself, well, how fantastic is that? You must have the strength of a lion, as I tell lots of people, because it's a different journey to others. So yes, all of these things to enrich yourself and life. You have so much to offer. And generally speaking, because it's lovely when I lecture, that the adopted students or students who've been cared for might gravitate, because they know I'm interested. And yeah, I am really interested. Find the people interested in you, because they'll be the right people. In the kind of your education, find the right teachers. Find the right people who are compassionate and will respect your journey and the courage it's taken. So it was a long answer, wasn't it?
There's lots to go at there. For me, the essence of this is, because I have a lot of these conversations and I do a lot of research about what other people are doing. And to me, I say this every now and again on the podcast. It seems to me that we've kind of become trauma obsessed when we should be trauma informed and hope obsessed, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because, you know, like, hope's about hope, isn't it? You know, trauma's the darkness. And we've got to understand the darkness and then focus towards the light.
Mm-hmm. That's so eloquent, because the psychoeducation, the understanding what's happening and why, shifts the guilt and blame. So you're absolutely right. It's understanding and then finding steps forward. So yeah. I always try to do a little bit of education for families around why things maybe as they are. Because trauma can cause dissociation, it can cause flashbacks, hypervigilance. Your child might scan the room with worry, but there are things you can do. And that normalizing it is a step to recovery, isn't it?
Yeah. You see, the other thing for me is trauma is, it's a term that's kind of bandied around. And sometimes we talk about, when sometimes we say trauma, we mean an event. Like, so when we watch a lot of rubbish on telly, you know, and it's a blunt force trauma or something like that, you know, it's in a physical, you know, from a physical perspective, in a cop show, somebody has been murdered and it's blunt force trauma, right? So that's an event that's happened. So we look at a traumatic, when we talk about trauma, we talk about the trauma of separation or the trauma of events. Sometimes we're talking about trauma, trauma as a feeling. Mm. So we're talking about anger, We're talking about, sometimes talking about anger, sometimes we're talking about self-esteem, sometimes we're talking about insecurity, sometimes we're talking about thoughts, sometimes we're talking about it from behavior. And it's just like none of those, it's all very, you know, as you say, complicated thinking. And it is really complicated. But the fact is, the simple fact is, we're not our past. We're not the events that have happened to us. We're not the feelings. We're not the feelings in our hearts. We're not the thoughts in our heads, and we're not our behaviour. You know, you started this before we started recording. You said, "Are you all?" You know, I said, "You said, oh, you're so positive. You're so happy. Are you always like this?" And I said, "Well, I have my moments, but I'm not faking it." I get as cheesed off as anybody in traffic jams, or I'm a swimmer, so I often talk about this. Like I get cheesed off when there's too many people in the lane, and I can't do my lengths, and it's all too hard work. You know, the waves are too choppy, and people are slow, and I want to get in, and I want to get out, and get back on to my podcast. But our feelings and our thoughts and our behaviour. All of these things change. Mm. They're not who we are. And for me, we seem to have got feeling and being really mixed up. So if I ask you, how are you? You had a cold last time we spoke.
Yeah.
How are you? Then I could be asking, how are you physically? I could be asking, how are you? And I'm asking you, how are you feeling? But our feelings, but how are you? Well, you never change. Your thoughts and feelings are added to you. They're not who you are. But we're obsessed, aren't we, with our thoughts and feelings? And we don't spend as much time thinking about that identity, that that stuff of who we are underneath all those things.
In a Pitt village and didn't go to really kind of amazing schools, but I think I've got there. I've studied a lot since I left school at 16. And
hi again. Sorry, we had some technical issues there. So, Steph, you were talking about your school and starting a story off that. So can we pick that back up there?
Oh, thanks, Simon. I guess I try really hard to understand as much as I can around trauma, attachment, adoption. I love studying. I love learning. And you were coming up with some thoughtful points about thoughts, feelings, emotions, because any early trauma is going to affect the brain, and it's going to affect your amygdala, which gives you more wobbly emotions. Young children, I'll talk about having a wobbly amygdala and how we take control of that fight or flight. And I'm always trying to develop, and I was reading recently about reductivism in mental health, where we kind of reduce people to diagnosis. And actually, I think you were talking about thoughts and feelings, and I think we forget that many of them are understandable, and we can be quite reductivist. We can reduce children, people to, oh, they've had this happen, or they've experienced this, and they've got these limitations, or they've got this diagnosis. And we really should be changing the narrative to look at the strength of this young person, look at their capacity for human growth, despite what they've experienced. This reductivism, and I experienced something horrible the other day. Somebody was really unpleasant, and I looked back and I think they were really trying to reduce me, to attack things that are my strengths and skills. And when people do that, it's not to do with you generally, it's to do with how they feel. And I think that can happen to those who've experienced attachment and trauma, unfortunately, because some of the people in the network don't have the skills and knowledge. So it can end up a bit medical model or a bit reductive of, oh, it's this or it's that, rather than capacity building. So I'm quite in favour of the Adoption Support Fund, because I think it's that recognition that if you've had difficult experiences, the space and the choice to pick a therapist and they'll be connected and support you and your family is a good thing.
Yeah.
So I hope that doesn't cease. But yeah, I think we can be reductivist and reduce people who are having a natural response to challenge and circumstance. And as you say, thoughts and feelings change. Today I feel robust. I've not had anything to knock me. I'm doing a lovely podcast and it's an opportunity to reflect on a really interesting career with fabulous people and families. But I suspect if you've been adopted, these kind of reductivism attitudes or knocks will happen more, because that early challenge can affect, for some children, their education. There's more special educational needs, because I think we need more catch up for these children, more nurturing to feel safe in school, and the right school environments. I think some children do need the really kind of nurture and support, access to health and education plans being easier and not so long. But I totally agree with you. We are much more
so, Steph,
more than thoughts and feelings, because they're past.
Sorry, we've just lost you for a minute there, Steph. How do our expectations of kids impact those kids?
Oh, I think hugely. One of my classic, it says our internet's unstable again, so do pause me if we have another glitch.
Will do.
I think a classic phrase that I use, probably because I'd like, with permission in the co-production, to share reports that families and children are happy with. And this, the issue, I guess, with education is if you're flooded with thoughts and feelings that are tough at that time, that will change, they're not forever, they're circumstantial and maybe episodes of care patients. When you've been adopted are hard, because and movements and changes in time, changes of school, changes in families. And a lot, you will have a challenge. And the phrase I use a lot for schools is, at this time, it's really difficult for this child to access the curriculum. It's really difficult if you're burdened by worry, stress, trauma symptoms. And these are the things that may help, you know, sensory areas, nurture groups, trusted attachment figures in school, approaches that are sensitive to transition. All of these things can make a huge difference on a child's capacity to access the curriculum. So as you said eloquently earlier, it's about being trauma informed. It's about being open-minded and sharing with the network and family about how you can best help.
Yeah.
So a child can thrive. So there is a real value in the podcasts and the information sharing, because we're still not at a point, I think, that society fully understands in the right way. I hope we move to that. I do hope we move to something far more respectful of how fantastic a lot of young people are doing, and adults who've been adopted across the lifespan. Because I was influenced, after you've probably read it, Primal Wound. I read it years ago, and even the children, the rare children who relinquished and given up at birth, where it used to be felt there'd be no trauma, there is still a resonance and a loss and a perceived rejection and a need for it to be understood, I think. But okay. Yeah,
I've got a completely contrarian view on the primal wound.
Oh, interesting.
So my question to you is, if you could sum it up in one word or one or two words or just one sentence, right? What's wounded?
Wounded. Oh, the film, from the research we made for Social Work England, we called it Attachment Wounds and the Wounded Healer. Because I do believe sometimes people who've been through the hardest things can be the best people to help others recover, to know best if they feel they have the courage to share the story. So wounds, I think attachment wounds is a good phrase. I think if you have a tough start, it can feel like a wound or a sorrow or a source of pain. Obviously, I'm not the one to say the language. I think it's really important. Children's services are trying to use better language, you know, cared for children rather than looked after, and family time rather than contact, for example. But wound for me captures it. I think some children say it's like being hit by a bus when they've experienced trauma. And so it's worked when I've shared that with families as language, but they have a choice. But yes, how do I, that would wound. I think it's a hurt that needs recovery from by care, compassion and understanding.
So I was chatting to somebody a couple of days ago for the podcast, and he summed it up really well. A wound sounds like an injury.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's what she's putting forward, is Nancy Dyer's her theory, right? For me, it's more like a pain. So it's not an injury, it's a pain. So when I ask what's wounded, sometimes it really hurt me in the past. Mm. Right? It hurt my feelings.
Yeah,
I'm not my feelings, and it's not a wound. It's not an injury. It's not a wound like a cut to my arm, because who I am can't be wounded. You know that have you heard that? I say this phrase a lot. Where this French guy came up with this saying, we're not human beings having a spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings having a human experience. So if we shrink that down, say, well, we are spirit. So spirit isn't a thing. So it's not a thing that can be wounded. So wounding, the primal wound for me is feelings of pain,
mm-hmm.
not an injury of who I truly am.
That's beautifully put, Simon, because you're absolutely right, because a lot of the pain's related to shame, and it shouldn't be shameful. But that is beautifully put, I think. And yes, I think pain probably does sum up, because my friend Colin McGinn, I'm lucky to have worked with and presented, and I think he'd do a great podcast, but Colin reviews research so meticulously, and he helped me think about, you know, the MRI scanning that of rejected adults, and the pain part of the brain lit up. Colin explains it far better than me, but it really was helpful for me to think, actually, it can cause genuine pain to be rejected. And I think it makes sense for the children who get tummy aches and stress headaches, that trauma, loss, rejection do cause pain. So I think pain probably does explain it. And I like the point you made beautifully, that it's not you. It's just feelings. They're not you. It's a pain that I hope passes, or find a way to feel less pain.
Yeah.
Or manage that pain, or understand that pain. Because it would be a wonderful thing if all children had an easy start. I feel too for the human rights and adoption research. I think we've been hit by austerity, something I've published on a couple of years ago, but the research and the study, not the grandiosity of me talking about publications, it was the study that really made me consider. We've had decades of public sector cuts, and I think the research on human rights and adoption, we probably have a lot of birth mums who, with better support, better funded services, we wouldn't have adoption happen. They would have been scaffolded to stay home. So I think adoption has so many meanings to so many people. You can have the birth parents demonized, and they're human too. We can have misperceptions about adopted children, adults. and misunderstandings of adoptive families who may have greater challenge, the parents. So I think that wider lens of understanding and probably better funded services. I hope we keep the adoption support fund. I hope also we think about the whole triangle of what everybody in the adoption needs to make less pain, because sometimes the children do then go on to search as adults. And if we don't forget the birth parents, maybe they'll be in a better place of recovery when they do the searching.
Yeah. So, Steph, I'm sorry to cut you off. I'm just conscious of time.
And I could talk forever about the topic. And
we will talk again.
Thank you. If you need anything re-recording, because I know I can talk enthusiastically, just let me know. But I hope anyone listening affected by adoption, from the biggest thing I would hope they take from this, is to really try to be proud of the courage and strength and bravery you have, because you haven't had an easy journey. But I hope you know that that can bring you post-traumatic growth and a real feeling of strength in what you've managed. So there's some super parents. There's some children and young people and adults who've been adopted with the hearts of lions and so much to offer. And I wish you the very best. And I'm grateful for anyone who took the time listening.
Wow, Steph, that was great. That really was great. So I hope you've all enjoyed that. Listeners, there'll be links in the show notes to Steph, so you can get in touch with her, check out what she's doing. And I'm keen for everybody I'm really looking forward to checking this film out, and hopefully we'll figure a way of sharing that with the listeners too. So thanks for listening, and thank you, Steph. You've been a lovely guest. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Simon.
I'll see you all soon. Thanks a lot, listeners. Bye-bye.